103. Always on the cutting edge.
Drive Time, welcome back. 0829-913-913. That's not an emergency number. That's our WhatsApp line. 0829-913-913. In today's book review, we check out Brent Meersman's Rattling the Cage, Reflections on Democratic South Africa. Rattling the Cage takes you, the reader, on a tour of South African reality, from Mandela to Marikana to envy, avarice, burning trains, and more. Don't worry, it's easy to read, it's accessible, and very well informed. Author Brent Meersman, who's online, is also co-editor of Ground Up, one of the last remaining individual unbiased media platforms around, also independent. He's also been the chairman of the Press Club since 2013, which is forever. And in 2020, his memoirs, A Childhood Made Up, was also published. Brent Meersman, welcome to the show.
Salam, Shafiq.
Salams to you. It certainly is a very interesting book, 17 pieces plus minus, and you move around in four sections, from fear and hope, envy and avarice, sadness and joy, disgust and offense, love and compassion, etc., etc., etc. What, first of all, gave you the motivation to tackle this book? Because you certainly cover the whole gamut of the South African reality.
Yes, well, I've been writing about South Africa for about 20 years or more, and of course I've lived through, you know, the 1980s and thought a lot about my country, and I wanted to reevaluate, you know, had I got the story straight, did I understand what was going on in South Africa, or had I just absorbed my social bubble? You know, did, were these just, you know, opinions and views that I had taken for granted, and to what extent? And I think, had I analyzed it, and I think it's very important for, you know, for all South Africans. I think we all people should, you know, we should investigate and we should think about the beliefs we hold and why we hold them. And as you mentioned, each section of the book is headlined with a pair of emotions, like, you know, like sadness and joy, or fear and hope. And I think that the way we understand our country is to a large extent informed by our experience of it, the extent to which we have done well or not so well, the extent to which we feel included or not included. And I wanted to put those uppermost in my readers' minds and keep that emotional argument there for how we understand South Africa.
No, absolutely. What I'm going to do to you, you start off by talking about Mandela's funeral. I'm just going to read out a few lines that you write about Mandela, because I think it kind of places us immediately in terms of what you're trying to do. Mandela, the man who now stands accused of selling out, quote unquote, is the same man who, together with the Youth League, ousted the old liberal thinking and sclerotic leadership of the ANC in 1949. Who launched the armed struggle by founding Umkhonto Sizwe, whom the ANC disciplined for his famous "We are closing a chapter on this question of a non-violence policy" interview in 1961, who refused to come to any compromise with the prosecution during the Rivonia trial, and who was prepared to hang. It's interesting you've managed to get all of that together in just, in fact, half a paragraph, but I'm sure you'll agree, this is exactly what you were trying to tell me previously, is that there are just so many different South African realities.
Yes, you know, so, you know, you look at that, Mandela was a radical, and certainly, and he was also a very pragmatic man and very humanistic in his approach, and he wanted, although he took up the armed struggle, ultimately he wanted a peaceful South Africa, and he did everything he possibly could do to achieve that. I mean, and of course we can ask questions, and I do ask the question, and I interrogate it in the book as to, you know, did Mandela get the best deal from international and from capital that he could have got in 1994? And that's a significant and interesting question. But this idea that Mandela is a sellout, you know, really sticks with me, and I've thought about it. And I have young born, you know, so-called born free. Nobody was born free. who say to me, you know, that, you know, Mandela sold out. He sold us out. That's why we have no jobs. That's why there is no land. That's why we are in the predicament we are. And I have to say to them that, no, I don't think that that's fair. And I think you characterizing it as a sellout, I think that's anger speaking. And I understand that anger. But it's the anger of the emotion to lash out at this sort of father figure who hasn't provided a reality that one would want. But with, certainly I think I make the argument quite, I hope, well, certainly I'm convinced, and I would like to see evidence against that he really was certainly not a sellout, and he did his absolute best. I think the ANC overall fell short in some of the negotiations, but I don't think that it's, you know, the sellout label is just the anger of youth speaking now, and people who did not live through that period.
It's ironic because Mandela was very aware of expectations. I can remember covering his first address in the Grand Parade, where one of the lines he said, and it stuck with me, he actually said, "I'm not a prophet. I'm just a basic human being, and I'm not a prophet," are the exact words that he used all those years ago.
Yes, and he repeated it many times, and he said, "I'm not a saint. I'm a sinner who keeps on sinning, but who tries to do better, who tries not to, you know, who tries to improve themselves." And he didn't want to be painted as this lifeless ideal. But at the same time, there is an important element in that he did transcend his own party, you know, and he did transcend many things. And as I make the point in the book as well, which is quite interesting, is that in the end of the day, it was Mandela who led the white nation, not black, when we got past 1994, you know. And that's an extraordinary accomplishment as well. And he had, you know, Mandela could ask people to do things which, if Zuma asked, or even Ramaphosa, you know, people would not necessarily do them. But, you know, he had that gravitas, and he had that incorruptible faith in him, which I think was a huge boon to the country at that time. But there were many, I mean, Adar Asmal, there were many other people, and Kathy, of course, you know, there were many people around him who supported him, and that we were very lucky with that class of people that we had at that time, I think.
No, absolutely. Because if one goes through your book, and there's a lot in it, so we're going to have to just jump around quite selectively. Your views on Marikana are interesting, and when one again steps back and looks at Marikana, it's almost like an allegory. There's just so much in Marikana, from what happened to the workers, Lonmin, Ramaphosa, neoliberalism, post-colonialism. It really encompasses a tremendous amount, doesn't it, apart from the tragedy of the massacre?
Yes. I think that, so you asked me earlier what made me write the book, and I have to say that probably Marikana was one of the most animating factors. It was such a shock. And I said to myself, how is it possible in democratic South Africa with our constitution, everything, how did it happen? And I'm afraid to say that looking at the reaction in post-Marikana, I fear that we are probably going to have another one down the line. I hate to say it, but I don't see significant changes on the ground in a way that will prevent such a thing happening again. There's a lot of lip service paid afterward. But for me, it was a microcosm. I mean, if you looked at it, you saw this overpaid management at Marikana with a callous disregard for the welfare of their employees, even though there were black economic empowerment elements sitting on the board of Marikana, and there were companies there to manage the labor relations that failed. There was a subversion of the unions. We were in collusion with the management and then left a vacuum open. There was the militarization of the police that we've had. There was a lack of living conditions. You know, the workers live in squalor and still do after Marikana. And then the failure of transformation in the industry, and then the collusion of the state with the whole minerals and energy complex, you know, with big capital, and then the opportunism of demagogues like Julian Salema, who pitched up there and started having a political success on what was the ANC's turf. So all those elements together, I think, really make Marikana an instructive and important lesson for us, and why we should not shy away from, where we should look, you know, really look it in the eyes, and also ask ourselves, what have we done since? And I'm afraid, the country has done nearly enough since Marikana, even though there was this huge outpouring and there's this annual commemoration. On the ground, you know, the Marikana miners are still suffering, and their widows are still suffering.
Absolutely. There's been no closure at all. And it's interesting, something that we discovered at this radio station, and everybody else did as well, but it came home very profoundly to us, is that the miners at Marikana, their biggest problem was actually debt. They'd become enslaved to the micro lenders. And again, that becomes a whole other story. But on the face of it, their demands for 12,500 rand a month were not unreasonable.
No, they weren't, and certainly some economists, I haven't been able to evaluate, as I'm not an economist on that level that I can actually evaluate, the figures, but certainly it has been presented by economists, and I feel quite convincingly, so I mentioned it in the book, and people must have a look at it for themselves, that there was actually enough, there were sufficient funds to probably give the increases that they were demanding, and if not that, there were billions that were available that were offshore to tax havens on islands to the west of us, which itself, those billions, if they'd just been put into infrastructure, would have made a huge, such a difference to the lives of the workers that perhaps they could actually have a tolerable life and with some dignity exist on their meager salaries. So the problem is, and also if you look at it elsewhere in the world and look at comparative pay, people like the rock drillers at Marikana and many menial workers in South Africa are paid a pittance, which counterparts in a country like Australia or in Europe would be paid. However, our top management and our CEOs and that are paid almost exactly the same as what CEOs and people earn. In countries that are that developed. So we really have to look at that. The Marikana management was earning on average like 200 times the wage of the lowest paid people at the mine. And that's an enormous differential. There's all these things that we need to look at. And of course, you mentioned the debt trap. You know, that also is a legacy of migrant mining labor. Mm-hmm. That's part of the legacy.
You mentioned something else in your book, talking about our suburban realities. You're right. You cannot have a million rand status vehicle watched over by a legless, unemployed man and be proudly South African and declare your country a success. I mean, this is your very own neighborhood.
Yes, absolutely. I live in Tambuurskloof, right in Cape Town. And I don't live in a fancy place, but I suppose it is a pretty good place. But the location, I've just noticed over the years, more and more sports cars. It's quite incredible with the economy. And as I mentioned in the book, with COVID, because I heard, I think it was Stephen Curtis on the SAFM interviews, it was the economic roundup or whatever, and they were talking about how bad the economy was dipping during the lockdown. And he had a throwaway line like, oh, well, not many Maseratis being bought right now in this economy. And I thought, no, actually, that's not the case.
Yeah.
In fact, there are as many Maseratis and Porsches being bought, if not more, right throughout this COVID lockdown. That is how well insulated the rich are in South Africa. From the realities on the ground, so the poor are suffering, but the super wealthy are quite untouched by all of this, and really are insulated. So that was the point that I was trying to make around, Porsche mobility, I think I call it.
Yeah. There's so much to discuss. I was hoping we're going to be able to talk about the media. We haven't got time for that, but I'd like to focus in on your observations about Brett Murray's The Spear and Zuma talking about his experiences on the island and the Zuma that we see today. Zuma, it's a tragic story, isn't it? The story of Zuma right now. I mean, it's something it could have been, but simply never was.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because, I mean, I've met him a few times and I have interacted. I can't say that I know him well at all, not in the slightest. But certainly, the thing with politicians is that, you know, it's their job to make you like them.
Yeah.
So they're very, very effective at that. So one has to be very careful. And yes, it's certainly the man that I met just coming out of Robben Island and before he was, when he was still just the treasurer, I think it was, of the ANC. He was a very different man from what emerged as a president in my eyes, and has subsequently, and also now with this recent behavior around the Zondo Commission, which is really quite indefensible. Yes, so I was quite taken by that. But then I've spoken to other comrades, and they say, no, you were just fooled because he's always been like that. So there are differences even within people that work quite closely with him. So I'm not quite sure what to say about that. I do think that, you know, not everybody in the liberation movement was of the same kind of stature as Tambo or Sisulu or Ahmed Kathrada or Mandela. Some of them, you know, had other agendas, it would appear, or looked out for number one always and have continued to do so.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Brent, we have to leave it there. I think we could have carried on chatting until sunset, but radio doesn't allow us to do it. But
well, congratulations on your radio, by the way. It's one of the great success stories. Community radio started 1995 around there, I think, around just after the one of the first with getting the licenses.
That's right. Yes.
Newcastle was still doing its job. Excellent, and congratulations to you.
No, thank you for that. And of course, I'm now going to talk about your book, Rattling the Cage, Reflections on Democratic South Africa. It's published by Picador. It will be at a bookshelf near you. And as I say, I recommend it's a good read. It is a page turner. It's easy to read. It's accessible. And there's just bags and bags of information about South Africa and the state of our country. Brent Meersman, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Everything of the best with the sales of the book.
Shukran.
Afwan.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting.